This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
All right, so the evaluating the effects of technology. Obviously, this is a wide open topic. This could head many directions. We could talk about the effects of brain development. We could talk about the effects on learning. And we're going to hit those areas kind of briefly, each one, but there's so many things that could be said about each topic. And so I chose a title that didn't really box us in to a particular domain of this study. But I'd like to begin with this Bible verse and help us think about the power of this verse in informing our use of technology. Colossians 3:15, it's on your notes. And let the peace of God rule your hearts, to the which also ye are called in one body, and be ye thankful. 3 points. Pretty straightforward. First of all, a call to peace. Obviously, something rules your life. Something is ruling your energies, your passions, your time. Something's ruling that. Something is controlling that. To some degree, the call is, let the peace of God rule your heart. I think there's a connection between that call and our use of technology. At least it certainly is in my life. I'll come back to that later. A call to unity. The context here and other versions that I looked at all say the same thing. This is about being members one of another. So a call to, we could say, brotherhood or unity or connectedness. That has a lot to do with technology. A call to good connectedness and the one body concept. We are truly members one of another. How does technology affect that? Some huge implications, are there not? And then a call to thankfulness, just kind of tucked on the end. Peace, brotherhood, and be a thankful person. For those who can think back and for those who cannot, try to imagine what your last week would have been like, tech-free.
It was
tech-free. You did not bring.
I did, but no service.
Oh, what a blessing. I wonder if Faith Builders could actually do something that would just block absolutely all connections inside this building. How many of you were frustrated with the lack of service this week? All right. Well, I had some frustrations because I'm trying to stay connected to my wife and my children, and I need to step out every time I want to do that for cell service. So I think it would just be really good for you and I to spend a little bit of time. I'd encourage you to do this. I know none of you will, or most of you won't, but I would still encourage you to do it. To just spend a little bit of time really thinking of what your days would be like tech-free. In other words, what I think it's important to do is try to think back 20, 30 years, or maybe think back how God created us and the world. What would that be like? Now, there would be some components that, of course, none of us really would say that's what we want because we're using technology in good ways. But there are also some things that might say, wow, wouldn't that be something? How did God create our relationships? How did God create family and community? How can we have that in spite of using the technology and not allow it to ruin God's plan for people and connectedness? And I, in my own family and in my own life, I keep thinking of that. How can I return in ways that I need to, we need to? How can I get back 30 years? How can I get back there in some ways, in terms of relationships and connectedness? And what are we doing that is disrupting that in ways that are outside of what is healthy? So now let's go back to these words. How is technology affecting peace? Just a sense of rest and peacefulness, connectedness to God. Can technology interrupt the call to peace ruling our lives? Because other things are indeed ruling our lives. People are in bondage. I would like to be free, but don't want to pay the price. How's it affecting our relationships? Hugely, isn't it? Again, we'll look at that under socially later. But think of the call to brotherhood and connectedness and how technology disrupts that or makes it more difficult, at least more difficult. And thankfulness. Wow, can technology affect your thankfulness? It sure can. It can make you very discontent with your lot in life as you observe everybody else's amazing life that they're living. It can affect your thankfulness. So when we use technology, I'm talking about digital technology, because technically technology is simply the use of science to make life easier. So technology is a very, very broad term, but obviously we're focusing more specifically on the use of digital technology. I assume that's what you were expecting. But let's go ahead and just look. How many of you have seen this book? All right, so then there's no use. I read a lot of it. I'm going to just refer to a few books a lot more than I normally do because they say some things that it's just easiest to refer to directly. So I'm just going to give a couple things of alarms that were given throughout the years about technology, the advancement of technology, and how it's going to ruin our lives. And some of this would not be digital technology as such. So way back, this Swiss scientist, Conrad, he saw the rapid increase in technology and information among the public. After all, how much knowledge can any one man use? What effect will this overload of information have on society? He raised the alarm, but he died in 1565. Newspapers, alarm bells again sounded. This French lawyer pled with his government in 1775 to reconsider this dangerous innovation. He reminded them that the pulpit had historically been the primary source of information. Imagine what would happen to society if men were able to access the news in the privacy of their homes. 1775, that was. The public schools, 1883. The Sanitarian and New York Weekly Medical Journal warned against another hazardous innovation, the introduction of public schools. Listen to this. Placing children in confined classrooms, flooding them with information, seemed risky. Your school students would agree. Excessive study was considered a leading cause of insanity at the time. Now I agree. The Sanitarian argued that these schools exhaust the children's brains and nervous systems with complex and multiple studies and ruin their bodies by protracted imprisonment. There's some things to think about there. There really was. That was from the medical standpoint and the developmental standpoint of children. Their bodies, mentally, their nerves. They have something to say there. They really do. Well, of course, transportation, some incredible alarms. 1825, the railroad opened, the British Scotland Darling Railroad opened in 1825. It was met with great apprehension. This was the first public railroad to use steam locomotives, and the thought of traveling at an incredible 30 miles an hour seemed horrifying. Speculations arose that moving that fast might kill you in gruesome ways, such as your body melting. That was at 35 miles per hour. Communication, of course, the contraption of the telephone, the idea that voices would go through a wire was very alarming. So there's been alarm at every level as technology advanced, and for good reasons. Will one day they chuckle at our alarm of the smartphone and Google? I don't know, but possibly in 2000, whatever, out there somewhere. I find this amazing. Listen to this. In 2005, CNN published an article proclaiming emails hurt IQ. This made it into CNN. More, are you ready, than pot. A British newspaper in 2009 reported using Facebook could raise your risk of cancer. Now, that seems to me, offhand, we'd say that's not substantiated. But it made it into a British newspaper. So I'm just reading what they said. They said Twitter and Facebook could harm moral values. Agree on that one. That's pretty easy, don't we agree? And the influential Atlantic magazine produced an article asking the thought-provoking question, is Google making us stupid? Is Google making us stupid? Well, there's some good questions, at least, that people are asking. I have found this so amazing that the very people who are producing this technology are protecting themselves and their children from it. I'm going to just read you a little something from the book, Irresistible. How many have this book or read it? Nobody. Well, it's on your suggested to read list at the end. I just threw in a few books that I really like. Irresistible. Listen to this carefully. In the late 2010, this will be Microsoft connections, of course, Steve Jobs. Jobs told New York Times journalists that his children never use the iPad. Steve Jobs, the creator of all of this, or some of this, the brains behind it, his children never used the iPad. That was only in 2010. We limit how much technology our kids use in the home. Built-in discovered that other tech giants impose similar restrictions. Chris Anderson, the former editor of Wired, enforced strict time limits on every device in his home because we have seen the dangers of technology firsthand. His five children were never allowed to use screens in their bedrooms. Evans Williams, a founder of Blogger, Twitter, Medium, bought hundreds of books for his two sons, but refused to give them an iPad. Leslie Gold, the founder of an analytic company, imposed strict no time during the week rule on her children. She softened her stance only when they needed computers for homework. Walter Isaacson, who ate dinner with the Jobs family while researching his book, said no one ever pulled out an iPad or computer. The children did not seem addicted at all to devices. Now listen to this statement at the end. It seems as if the people producing tech products were following the cardinal rule of drug dealers. Never get high on your own supply. So a drug cartel, somebody who's kind of the big guy in the drug world, right? Got all these people under him. They know, don't get high on your own supply. You're supplying all these people. They're becoming addicted. You're becoming rich. But don't become high on it yourself, or you'll ruin yourself like you're ruining those people. This seems sinister to me, doesn't it to you? That these men are producing things that they know are addictive. They're becoming billionaires, but their own children can't touch it. Or at least it's highly restricted. Some of these people send their children to no-tech schools. I read it. You realize that? These people from Silicon Valley who are producing these things for schools, pushing it. Some of these men said, every child in America, all our schools, iPads, the way to go. And then they secretly send their children to no-tech schools. They certainly do. You can research it. And now here we are. We're trying to catch up, you know. with the tech. And they're saying, it seems sinister, does it not? He says, this is unsettling. Why are the world's greatest public technocrats also the greatest private technophobes? One comment here, there are 1,000 people on the other side of the screen whose job it is to break down the self-regulation you have. How many have ever heard of Candy Crush?
You said heard of.
I figured somebody would call me out on that one. All right, I won't ask any more questions. The game Candy Crush is a prime example. At its peak in 2013, the game generated more than $600,000 in revenue per day. That's from downloads. To date, its developer, King, has earned around $2.5 billion from the game. What a simple game. I never played it, but I read about it in here. What a simple game. It says, let me just jump down to it. It is hard to understand the game's colossal success when you see how straightforward it is. Players aim to create lines of three or more of the same candy by swiping candies left to right, up and down. Candies are crushed. They disappear when you form these matching lines, and the candies above them drop down to take their place. Pretty juvenile. The game ends when the screen fills with candies that can't be matched. And then they talk about the addictive power. Just enough of juice, they call it. Enough that gets people excited, enough of feedback, of success, but just also elusive enough that it draws them in. $600,000 a day on Candy Crush for a little time frame. The addictive powers of technology. Are you addicted to technology? Are you willing to pay the price? There's a book out there. I have not read the book. I've seen reviews, heard reviews, called Digital Minimalism. It's on your list as well by Mr. Thomas or whatever his name is. Cal something. It's not Cal Thomas. I always think of him. It's another man. Check it out, where he goes into this addiction thing and digital minimalism. It's just a personal way to kind of work your way through some of these questions. All right, I would suggest that here would be one way of thinking about your own use, is that technology is a tool, not a toy. All right? If you can make that one of your guiding principles, however you're going to interpret that is, of course, there's some subjectivity there, but one of the effects that we want to avoid of the addictions and the waste of time is to have some principles in line here. This is where I'm drawing some lines, and that I find helpful. Is this a tool or is this a toy? Is it entertainment? Now, that is not to say that all technology that has entertainment components are wrong. I'm not going to say that. But it's one way to think through it and put your use in categories and decide how much of the toy category you want to afford in your life. Versus these are tools. But let me also suggest that just because it is a tool does not mean that at the end of the day, it's justifiable. Okay, so let's think of this. This is a tool in our school, let's say. So let me flip to something that's, you know, a little, maybe not quite as personal because you're doing this in your school. What a tool. It's how we do our flashcards. It's how we do our reviews. We can Google all kinds of things for research papers, whatever it is. Okay, so this is a tool. Check that box. It is efficient, and it is. Take the time. I'm embarrassed when I have last been at the library, and I do a lot of research in curriculum development at Christian Light. If you think I would go to the library and get a book to find that there's one page of what I want when I can do that in 30 seconds? So it is incredibly efficient. Okay, so that's good. Is it effective, though? So we have another word to look at. Is it effective? Well, sometimes it is. It is effective. It is effective for the children. Sometimes, though, is it effective? Are we sure? It's efficient, but is it effective? And the other thing is, educators, that I am really burdened that we think about this question. Children increasingly are not seeing you as the source of information. Okay? Children increasingly are not seeing their teacher and their parent and their preacher as the source of information. It's here, it's here, it's here. Ultimately, it's Google and other research that you can do online. And that really, really is concerning to me. Because what we're tending to do is we are compartmentalizing information somewhat. Okay, this is information. This is wisdom. And so in the minds of students, I don't think they can separate that. In our minds, we want to. We want to say, well, this is just information. Google it. Find out quickly. Download it. Whatever, you know. I'm not going to really help you find it. I don't have much to say about it. And again, we're going to do some of that. But then when we want to talk to them, to impart to them life skills, life lessons, wisdom, you know, you're wasting my time. Why, you know, let's get over class. Let's stop talking. I want to get to work. I can find that answer somewhere else. Quit talking. We're facing that. A sense of, it's almost a bother when the teacher talks too much. You know, I can find my answers elsewhere. And we're creating a disconnect between what the child needs to learn and grow and the importance of the authorities that impart that wisdom. And that, I think, is part of why those tech people will not allow their children, because it creates a disconnect. It's addictive and all those things as well, but it also creates a separation, a disconnect between authority and children. And I think we should really think long and hard about that. How did God create us? What did God tell the fathers to do? When they are walking, when they are talking, when they are, what all the list is in Deuteronomy 6, when they're eating, when thou liest down, be talking, be training, be a flow of information and discipling and mentoring and shaping to your children. Instead, we have relegated a huge portion of that to technology. Let them do it. Am I making sense? So it's not just that this is evil and bad, because it isn't always evil and bad, or it would be a simple decision. It is also the consequence of relationship between authorities and those under them that I think really, really matters. Now, I like to think of reasonable risk. We can swing to the side of no technology. There's been recent church splits in a number of groups over this issue. And I am in no way critical of groups that say, listen, we will have no technology, digital technology, at all, ever. We're drawing the line here. You may not go even to the library and use the internet. No. You're just, no email. I am not in any way. Those might be the groups that survive, let me tell you, in 50 years from now. I'm not part of a group like that, but I do not disdain their carefulness. Most of us are in groups and have personally decided we will take, I'm going to call it, reasonable risk. So I'm comfortable, I think I still am, although some days I'm not so sure I am, with trying to take reasonable risk. But please, oh please, remember, it is a risk. Will we take reasonable risk? Driving 60 versus 30, we decide, is reasonable risk. I happen to be in Pennsylvania's capital when the argument was in Harrisburg over upping the speed limit, I think, to 60 or 65. This was a few years ago. And, you know, there was the argument. More people will be killed. You drive faster, there's more accidents. Yeah, why are we all driving just 30? Think of it. If everybody in the United States would just drive 20, 30 miles an hour, we'd have so few accidents. But the argument was, it's a reasonable risk. Yes, more people will die, but look at all the good of going faster. And so we all go faster, and more people dying. All right, what about going 80, 90? Let's get it up to 90. And we said, that's beyond reasonable risk. That's just too much. So where are you going to decide? 90, 80, 70, 60, 50? How fast? What are you going to call reasonable? How much damage do you want to see happen? How many people killed and hurt? Well, this many. It's a little bit what we're almost doing, right? And it's just nice to drive that fast. You get there faster. We're doing a little bit with technology. A little bit, and a little more. Yeah, we're going to have more fallout. We're going to have more people that get in trouble and do things they shouldn't. But, let's be careful. Let's be accountable. Let's be transparent and really drill the principles. Drill the principles, teach them. We live in a world where there's lots of technology. It may as well get used to it. How far do you want to move that line in your own life, in the life of your children? How much risk do you want to take? Well, I've chosen to take some reasonable risk. But let's not just keep bumping that and bumping that and bumping that, because it's so efficient. It's just so nice to have. It's so convenient. There's some consequences, but, we think the good outweighs it. It does at some point, but you've got to decide where to draw the line and don't get swept along, because there's consequences to those choices. I would encourage you to take time to write down your values, letter A. Take time to write them down. What are your values? Think about them carefully. What do you value in relationship, in time, whether it's reading books, reading the Bible, time to spend with your friends, with your family? What are your values? Establish those firmly, and then see where technology can be a blessing inside that framework. Aren't we too often just doing the opposite? Here's the technology I want to use, and then, I do still have time to do that. I can still do that. And I still have time to read books and be with some people, but let's start with that. What are our values? What do we really want? What do you want home life to look like? What do you want relationships to look like? What do you want church life to look like? Make that non-negotiable. This is what we want. Now, can technology not destroy that? Some people say it will destroy it. We want zero. And I can respect that. But let's anchor not in efficiency and what is nice to do and the pressures we're facing. And then, hopefully we'll still have time to do these things. No, let's anchor it in the principles and in our values and then see how technology can be a blessing. But think how quickly technology interferes with those values. How quickly. We won't have time to talk to our friends, but we all have our phones out. We're just, it's just that habit of just getting them out. It vibrates. We just get them out. No, I thought we wanted to talk and have connectedness. So what trumped what? What became more important? Point B, consider the trades involved in tech issues. It's a trade. We talk about this at home sometime. Life is full of trades. It just is. I choose to go here one evening, then I didn't do this. And that can almost seem cruel. But I think we need to be honest with life is full of trades. We are prioritized. We get done what we want to get done. We pursue the relationships we want to pursue. We read the books we really want to read. And so it is trades. As I use technology, I'm trading it for something. So think of the trades involved in your use of technology. Again, we conclude some of those are good trades. This isn't evil versus good. This can be okay versus better. All right? So let's not create this dichotomy that it's, this terrible thing over here or that's a really good thing. Well, that's easy to decide then. But it is some things that are good and okay versus things that are better. And in 10, 20 years, we might look back and say, wow, why didn't we choose the better instead of getting swept along with what we thought at the time was good and okay. Any questions on that? Because I'll move a little more directly into effects. Or something I said that didn't make sense. All right, let's go to the next section. I want to look a little bit at brain development. Just spend a little bit of time here, not a lot. What is the effect on actual brain development and even altering brains when you're older? Just read just briefly here a few things from research. Studies have shown that children under 2, learn less from videos than when learning from another person. That seems rather obvious, but interesting to think about. That carries on way beyond two. In other words, they're watching it on a screen. It's a person talking, but versus the real interaction of the person. They learn less. And it appears as though children will watch the TV screen by 6 months, although it appears. Understanding the content does not usually happen until after age two. Some little children, I think they were about the age of two or three, they were shown a screen with a bowl of popcorn. And they ask the children, if we get this screen and we turn it upside down, will the popcorn fall out? Yes, of course it'll fall out. We're turning the screen upside down, right? So they didn't understand the reality. What is real? What's really happening? They get older, they come to understand that. But just was a fascinating study to show that the children's ability to understand context is very minimal. Let me just pick up maybe one other thing here. And this is, again, I think fairly obvious, but fascinating. These are the conclusions. If young children spend most of their time engaging with an iPad, smartphone, television, all of which are highly entertaining, it can be hard to get them engaged in non-electronic activities. Well, this is making a lot of sense, even with our children. Such as playing with toys to foster imagination and creativity, exploring outdoors, and playing with other children to develop appropriate social skills. Interacting almost exclusively with screens would be like working out only your arm muscles and nothing else. You would really have strong arm muscles, but at the expense of overall fitness. Are we seeing some of that in our people, in your children? Are you seeing any of that in yourself? Now, I didn't raise my hand to go on that nature walk yesterday either. It was five people, I believe, out of 300. I'm not suggesting that 10 years ago there would have been more, but I wonder. I know, at the end of the day, I'm tired too. Or play some volleyball. But are we having that general, is that an effect of technology? The flash, well, it's just mesmerizing. Walk outside, look at trees and plants, and have somebody tell us about it. I think there is a loss of interest in those kind of things. At least that propensity is certainly there. Why? I think it is truly an effect of technology. Another study, and this was, I think, about one of the most alarming things I read. This is not, I don't believe I know anymore where that is marked. So, it's easy to understand, little children, their brains are developing, they're going to definitely, what fires together, wires together, we say, we talked about that in our brain talk, it creates those circuits in your brain over and over again. After a while, it's just the easy way for us to think. They took adults that had not used technology and had them use the internet, and in 5 hours of use, they could see a difference in the brain scans. 5 hours. That is why Nicholas Carr says it is shaping our thought process. How we think. There were parts of the brain that lit up and were activated after 5 hours of use in the frontal lobe, those who are in the brain class again, the frontal lobe that had not, and it matched people who had used the internet extensively. Now, is that bad? I don't really know. I hope not, because my brain would really light up, I suppose. But it does mean that indeed it is affecting the actual anatomy of our brains. It is not just, I use technology. It is shaping actually the wiring in our brain and the circuitry of our brains. And when little children use technology, it is so much more. No wonder they're seeing little children who can hardly pay attention in school because of what the addictions that are happening in their brains. And I'm afraid I'm hearing teachers saying the same thing. They can tell which children go home and watch a lot of video because the distractedness in school is just not that exciting. We'll talk about that just a little more later. So, effect on the brain, it does actually, not only is this sort of a habit, or I like this, it is actually changing the circuitry of the brain. Well, relationally and socially, how's that affecting us? Well, I think that's pretty obvious, isn't it? Children who have a lot of technology, and I think even older people, have a harder time than reading the what we can call the emotional cues from each other. Sometimes we use the word emotional intelligence. I know there's sometimes children who grew up in very hard places and they don't have what we would call the normal emotional intelligence. They just don't read people as well. They don't really realize that this is upsetting somebody. They just don't read people. Well, can you imagine children and us sometimes, if our relationships are basically on the phone and with Facebook and all my friends I have all over the world or states with Facebook and other platforms of social media, even WhatsApp. And that's how I see sort of relationships. Those are my friends. And then when I'm sitting in a group of people to talk, I'm just a little uncomfortable. Now, of course, we're uncomfortable and it's people we don't know. But can you see that that is creating challenges of just knowing how to talk to each other? I saw a group of 8 boys sitting around one time and there were 8 phones out. It was almost comical. And unfortunately, the conversation that was taking place, the little bit, was mostly about the phones and what they were seeing on their phones. I would have loved to just say, fellows, just all put your phones down and just talk about life. And I really wonder what they would have done. See how quickly, even then when we are face-to-face, it can happen. Hopefully it's not happening to you. But it's one of the huge effects on our children is difficulty in just thinking of relationships, just talking to each other and feeling comfortable. As soon as it's not quite comfortable, we pull the phone out. Hope there's a new status or hope there's a message. Just do you do that sometimes when you're slightly awkward? A little uncomfortable, you just pull out your phone. Some of you do that? Well, you're really honest here. I like this. Yeah, I do sometimes. I do it at home sometimes when I'm just bored. And I have a daughter, she's 18, and she is a hawk. And I bless her for it. She's way more disciplined than I am. What are you doing on your phone, Dad? Just pulled it out. Put it back in your pocket. Woo! It's so good for me. But she is tenaciously determined to keep me accountable. Made me put an app on my phone that tracks my time. Made me, you know what I mean. And by the way, how many have an app on your phone that does that? I would encourage you to, and then look at it. That's what I tend to not do. Because when she says, Dad, can I see your phone today? Well, today I had a lot of interruptions and a lot of phone calls. Dad, show me your phone. I've been embarrassed. I pull my phone out and just look at that. Again, are you willing to pay the price? How many of you, how many times have I said, I don't like it? I don't like this, but I keep doing it because. Rudeness, I think, is another one of the consequences, and this is a sort of a pretty easy, obvious level. I was in a meeting recently, and it was very disturbing. This was a pretty serious meeting, just 3 of us. How often the one man pulled out his phone multiple times in that 1-hour meeting, pulled it out and looked at it, pulled it out and looked at it. Now, if you're in a group and you need to look at your phone, then tell them why. I did that, I think, just yesterday or the other day. I was talking to somebody, and I got a phone call. I said, I'm sorry, I really should take that. That's my wife. I know she has a question about something. Explain why, and then do it and apologize. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to check that message. Somebody's trying to get a hold of me. But just because your phone vibrated, just pull it out, look at it, the rudeness that we're getting used to with using our technology. You're really telling your friend, hey, I have another friend that is pretty important here. Another thing, and I think this has to do with thankfulness, and I'm going to talk about this under relationships, is FOMO. How many ever heard of FOMO? All right, it's a great acronym for fear of missing out. I think this has made me, definitely, and I think sometimes our young people, and I'm sorry to say young people, let's just say us, less thankful. Because what kind of things do you put on your phone or on Facebook or on your status? What kind of things? What a hard day of work in the garden. I hoed all that. Or, you know, look at this pile of dishes I need to do. Look at this dirty floor I need to clean up. It's the camping trips and the vacations. Not only, but certainly tips in that direction. That's what I tend to put on when I really had a good time. And it's like, hey. And so you're having a tough day. You get out your phone, there's 5, 10, 15 statuses. Oh, birthday party. Well, I wasn't invited. What the world? Can't believe, what? There's my friends. He went, she went. Whew. Wow, didn't know anything about it. What else? Oh, wow, they're out four-wheeling. Whoa, that looks fun. What is he doing? He's at the cabin. He's swimming. What am I doing, huh? Have you struggled with that? It looks like everybody's having a really good life. And guess what? When you put it on your phone, you're doing the same thing to them when they're back from the cabin and they're working. Now you're doing it to them. I guess you're getting even. I put statuses on once in a great while. I think it's fun. We moved just a week and a half ago. I put on at our birthday party for my wife and at our new house, and we do some of that. It's okay, our vacation, but let's be careful. The more we get sucked into the social media and this exchange of what we're doing in the fun, we are creating unthankfulness pretty quickly. And be ye thankful. Do you want to be responsible for generating that struggle in other people? And I can personally say I have certainly struggled more with thankfulness because of some of those things I've seen. That's why some people say, I just won't put it on because it just looks like I'm having this great life. It doesn't portray the real life, does it? It portrays that 5%, and we look and we know better, but it looks like it's maybe augmented to 50% of that person's life, or, you know, that's sort of what it is. And that's, again, I think a lot to think about. There is even addictions that they have traced for the likes, that slight little hit that your brain gets. Now, those who were in the class on the brain, the endogenous reward system, the part of our brain that gets those little highs, they have definitely been able to trace that people get that little rush. It's in the same part of the brain that addictions happen. But it's the same part of the brain that all of joys of life happen. So I'm not saying it's bad, but they're able to easily trace that. That's that little, and it's playing on the same system of that reward system in the brain. It's that slight addictive. You know what it's like? Some of you do. I certainly do. Let's go on to cognitively. Now, some of this maybe overlaps, but I wanted to talk about this in particular for a little bit. Cognitively, that means in our thinking. What is technology doing to our thinking? In the 1980s, this was just fascinating what happened. In the 1980s, educators were so excited. I'll just kind of illustrate it like this very quickly. So when you read a book, you are restricted, obviously, to what the book is saying. So let's take these two examples. Let's say these children are going to research Abraham Lincoln. And so you go to the library, you get them a book about Abraham Lincoln, and they read the book. Got it in their hands, they're reading it. They said, you know what? In the 1980s, they were able to create hypertext. This is going to be so much better. We're going to have them look up Abraham Lincoln, and they're going to read, and then we'll have a word here that is maybe blue, hypertext, and it says maybe during his childhood, he whatever. Now they can click on childhood and read all about his childhood. And then they come back and they keep reading, yada, yada, yada. They read about him. Here's another word, marriage. He got married at, oh, look it up. Click, new page. Talk all about his wife and his children, etc. Hypertext. What an expansion of opportunity beyond the text right here. Because you can't put everything here. If they want to look it up, that would be. They keep writing, then they talk about his political career. Oh, you could click on that. Look at all you could learn about his political career. Then you come back and you keep reading. And then you read about his assassination. How do you think that worked out? Do you think schools are still using hypertext? Well, I'm sure there's some. But the study has totally been a disappointment. As those children were given computers where they could click and link it to other things. I remember some of those days when my neighbor showed me some things online. It wouldn't have been quite in the 80s. It would have been, I guess, in the 90s. And how you could, you know, it could take you to this. And there's just pictures of this. Yes, I am that old. And I was like, wow. What a resource. And they have done repeated studies of people who read straight text, others who read with a hypertext so they could go out and then give them tests on what they knew. And hands down, it was always, I'm not saying every single person, but in a pool of people, it was always the confusion that that created. And they often couldn't even follow the story anymore and put it in decent sequence of, like, let's say, the person's life, because it just got distracted and distracted. And so what looked like an incredible tool, efficient and effective, all collapsed. So now you have to ask, why? What's going on? You mean we can't handle that? What I find amazing is to really think about the simple fact of how little you can be thinking about at one time. That's really what it comes down to. We call that sometimes, and I think it's going to be discussed some more later, so I'm just going to talk about it briefly. We talk about our working memory. Sometimes it's called the scratch pad of your mind. You can only be thinking about one little thing at a time. All you know, you're not even aware of until you pull that front. You know algebra. But now the different things about it, or you know a lot about a subject, but you're not conscious of it until you pull that front, right? And so we pull that front, or we're learning new information, short-term memory, we're pulling it front so we can think about it. Do you realize how little we can put on that scratch pad and assimilate? So think of reading. When children read a book, we can think of it as the drip, drip approach. They read, oh no, wait, I didn't quite get that. You go back and you read it again. Okay, now you can move on. You're holding that information, you're trying to tie it to other things you know. When you watch a video, how often do you stop? What did she say? What did he say? Go back again. Sure, you can, but it just pushes you along. It pushes you along. And so you're getting that information at a rate that you cannot assimilate. Your scratch pad just doesn't handle all of that. And at the end, it's confusion, and your brain, you know almost nothing. Have you ever done that? You heard something, you read something, it was just too fast-paced, and at the end, it was just a jumble. Do you ever do that to your students? I think I'm increasingly embarrassed in some of the talks I've had with my students through the years, and or lectures, and the speed at which we tend to go because we know it, and their little scratch pads are overwhelmed so quickly, simply called information overload. Pretty easy to understand. We experience that here at FB sometimes, don't we? Yeah, we do. And at the end, you say, wow, it was fascinating, but I don't really know if I could say any of those terms right now. And they're just kind of, and so, what is technology doing? It is making it difficult. It looks like such a tool, such an incredible tool, but sometimes it is overloading those little minds. And then while they sleep helps. Of course, it's not just while they sleep. Information is taken from the frontal lobe, short-term memory, and it is stored in long-term memory, in the hippocampus. Some of you maybe remember this little drawing. The hippocampus is highly responsible for taking what you learned and then placing it into long-term memory at many different places. So what we see, what we hear, information coming in on that scratch pad, we roll it around, but eventually needs to be put in the filing system of the long-term and actually placed at places where it belongs. Now, I find that incredibly fascinating. So if I meet somebody I never saw before and his name is Bill, so I look at him, he's Bill. Okay. That is Bill, okay. In time, your brain, if you don't forget, your brain will take that face and put it at a particular spot in your brain, and that is Bill. But if you would try to do 10 faces and 10 names, those names would all swirl around. Your brain would probably not tuck them in there with their names, at least for most of us. So appreciate how difficult it is to learn something new for most of us. And we think we dumped all this content, but to actually store it so that it can be brought back later to the scratch pad to think about it and use it, because we need to do that, right? So as soon as I would teach something new in math in my school, well, they need to pull front all kinds of things that they know already, all kinds of facts, all kinds of connections, and work with them and then add that to it. But if we go too fast And technology often does it because we have motion. We got the flash. We got what we're seeing and what we're hearing all poured in at one time on that tiny little scratch pad. And suddenly, it's just too much. Now, I do believe, as teachers, just one little thing about when we teach, we should use, if I would have just waved my hands up here about the scratch pad and the hippocampus, you probably wouldn't have much of a visual, would you? It's like, you know, can you just show me? But it is using two routes to our brains. Obviously, our eyes and our ears, but it's two processes is what I wanted to say. Scientists would say it uses two processes, and your brain can handle it if it's slow enough. And so sometimes we need to just carefully talk a little slower out of that problem. Just talk a little slower. Make sure people are seeing it so they can see that. And sometimes if we're talking too fast and drawing, and it's just overload. Well, again, technology is pretty cruel here, isn't it? Especially video, where it rushes the brain along and overload. You know, adults can get to the point where they can hardly even read a book. And that was some of the shock. Well, another book I would highly recommend is The Shallows. He talks about adult, educated people who are so addicted to technology and learning from technology that it has almost ruined their ability to read a book. They can hardly even read a few paragraphs because my phone, and they're just distracted. My brother was in college here a few years ago, and it's not really, I mean, he's smart, but he's not. I don't know that he's super smart, but he was at the top of his class when he graduated from nursing, it was a two-year program. Not that smart. He said other classmates would come to him and say, how do you study? How do you study? How do you sit there with your books and you're focused for a good amount of time? We just can't do that. He said, it was unbelievable. He's a college student paying pretty good bucks, this college. It was a high-speed college to get through and get your degree for nursing. He said, they were so undisciplined, it was unbelievable. And they talked about it. He said, we just can't do that. He said, well, you'd watch them. They'd be reading their phone. They get their phone out. Then they're back. Said, just dreadful. Am I the same way? Can you sit down with a good deep book and read for 1 hour straight? How many times do you check your phone when you're reading a book? How often do you check your phone when you're reading your Bible? It is making us incredibly undisciplined. Talked about that. Mark talked about that this morning, didn't he? The disciplines. I think it's making us undisciplined in various ways. Another way it's making us undisciplined is just easy information. Or I got to remember to do something. I do this sometimes. I pick up my phone and I say to my wife, hey, don't let me forget. We got to take care of the puppy shots this week. Back in my pocket. You know, I don't want to have to remember it. I don't want to have to write it down. You know, my secretary. So we can be very undisciplined because we're impulsive. We think of something quickly. And if we had a little more time to think about it, maybe we would have made a different choice. So think about your own life. What are the effects of technology on your own life in terms of being disciplined, especially when it comes to study and being able to read, and of course, relationships as well. The difficulty to pray focused. Not necessarily to pick up your phone in the middle, but think about discipline of the mind. Just so, so good. Are you willing to take a fast ever? It's a good thing to do. I love news. I love keeping up with politics. It is so good for me to tell my children, for 1 week, I commit, I won't even check the news. It's trades. How much time does that free up for you? Maybe just 2 minutes a day, maybe more. Could you use the time for something better? Just think of that. Or discipline yourself to, I'll allow so many minutes for Facebook a day or a week, or get off of it completely. Again, it's trades and it's discipline. It finally comes back to, what is the most important to you? Are you willing to pay the price? And closer related to some of this, just very quickly, spiritually, my concern, spiritually, our concern, obviously, is that spiritual things become less and less attractive. Listen, in our schools, if we need to have PowerPoints and video clips to keep our students' attention, what are the preachers supposed to do Sunday morning? Have our preachers say this. Now, I use PowerPoints. I use some videos once in a great, great while at school just to show something small. I know there is a pressure, and I'm going to stick my neck out, I'm going to say this. I think there is a pressure in our school to be an elite school, to be a good school, and the more tech you have, it seems you're getting there. I see that pressure in administration and in teachers. It's a little embarrassing to say, so how much, what technology do you use in your school? We actually don't use any. Oh, it's like, you know. You know what? You're running a school like the tech giants in the West would like to send their children to your school. Doesn't that kind of scratch your back a little bit? We use technology in school, some, but I'm concerned about the push for this. And so if this is part of, number one, making us look good, what's the motive for the technology in your school? If that is part of it. I'm not saying it is in every case. I'm just asking the questions. If our children are less and less able to sit and listen to a lecture, unless there's a little bit of flash. Again, what are we doing Sunday mornings? What are preachers under the pressure? What a long, boring 45-minute sermon that was. Just talking and talking and talking. Again, are we losing the value of its people who teach us? Because when we talk, we are imparting so much more than facts. Teachers, we must get a hold of this. Google cannot teach you wisdom. You cannot Google wisdom. You can Google facts. But you're getting nothing but bare facts. When we give the facts, we are doing more than just giving facts. We are imparting wisdom tucked around it, relationship. They see us as a source that we have something they need. And if we're not careful, we're hurting that. Google has something I need. It takes you too long to say it, or it's not zeroed in enough. Again, I don't have a problem with using Google. Children, we can download some things and give them the article, but we better be careful that we don't keep moving that line, or we can have a generation of people that don't value the wisdom of older people. I illustrate it like this sometimes at school to help our children just think about, that's your line of life. It's not very long. As a teacher, my line is this long. Been around a little longer. Doesn't mean I'm smarter, but I've seen more of life. My father, who I have a very close relationship to, his line is this long. I just love that line. I just love that line. There is a wisdom, knowledge that comes with that line. And if we're not careful, we don't appreciate those lines. We're the new generation. We know how to do it. We can learn fast. And we lose the truth, I believe the truth, of the value of the length of that line. That doesn't mean that they're always the best source of wisdom. We know that. But if we're not careful, again, our children don't see the value to that line. Well, God bless you as you go to your classrooms, as you think of technology in your own life, technology you're using in the classroom. Remember, set your values and then use technology accordingly.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.